Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the February Citizens Climate Lobby call. My name is Mark Reynolds, and I'm hosting today's call. What's going to be happening in just a few minutes, I'll be introducing our guest, James Balog, who we are so excited to have on the call. After that, we're going to get a legislative update from our Vice President of Government Affairs, Dr. Dana Richter. I think most of us on the call would have assumed by now that the reconciliation process would have wrapped up, but it's not. And Congress has some other things it's working on, so we're really excited to hear from our Government Affairs team about how things look going forward. After that, we're going to go over what we are asking you to do this month, following which I will go over some of the things that have happened since last month's call. Been some very exciting things, and I'm excited to tell you about them. And then the last thing I'm going to conclude with today is we're having our June conference in DC, and we're hoping to have it live and in person. But the lobbying is going to be either virtual or in district. And there's a component of that that is different this year, that's unique, that we've never done. And I'm excited about that. So I'll be wrapping up the call by sharing that with you. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to hear from Senator Coons. Last weekend, Senator Coons did a two-minute introduction to our Atlantic Region Conference, Mid-Atlantic Region Conference. And I thought his comments were really pertinent for all of us. So let's hear from Senator Coons, and then we'll have our guest on.
Hi, I'm U.S. Senator Chris Coons from Delaware. Welcome to the Citizens Climate Lobby Mid-Atlantic Regional Conference. I want to thank CCL for holding this conference again and express my sincere appreciation to Delaware members Marty Hopkins and Beth Chahes for being such fierce leaders on climate change at both the state and national levels. At last year's conference, I expressed my optimism that 2021 would be a year that brought climate change initiatives to the top of our domestic and global agenda, and it sure did. Every part of the world is today experiencing the impacts of climate change, and as the lowest-lying state in our nation, with an economy partly dependent on tourism and agriculture, Delaware is on the very front line of this ongoing global crisis. But this last year also brought some hope. One of President Biden's first actions was to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement, and in Congress, we've worked to make historic climate and clean energy investments that will benefit Delaware and our country, both through the American Rescue Plan and the bipartisan infrastructure law. Yet we still have so much more to do in the months ahead. I'm continuing to advance carbon pricing and border carbon adjustment policies in Congress and to work with our closest allies, Canada, the UK, and EU, because I believe it's the most effective way to align our climate ambition with our closest allies, to reduce carbon pollution, especially in the industrial sector across the West, and apply real pressure on other countries to decarbonize their export-oriented heavy industries and reduce their emissions as well. With significant investments now underway from President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law and a productive COP26 summit in Glasgow, we've made important strides this past year. I'm proud I was able to lead the first ever bipartisan delegation from the Senate to COP26 and learned a great deal from our meetings and our engagements in Glasgow. As we begin 2022, there's much more work we need to do, including the critical and unfinished work of enacting billions in clean energy tax credits and the creation of a new civilian climate corps. I'm not giving up on those important goals, and you can continue to play a critical role in that progress. Thank you for your commitment to climate action and to pushing elected leaders like myself and my colleagues to keep taking serious action to address climate change. I'm grateful for the work you've done and will do, and I look forward to tackling the challenges of this climate crisis together. Thank you.
Great. I know that most of the people on this call are pretty familiar with our guest James Balog's work and Balog, and that most of you have seen Chasing Ice, and some of you have seen it multiple times. You know, for 35 years, he's been making visible the impacts we're having on our planet. He's been making the invisible visible. As I said, many of you have already seen Chasing Ice, and we're excited to have him share with us about his new book, The Human Element, A Time Capsule from the Anthropocene. One of the things I find remarkable about his work is, you know, most people see science and art as somehow being at odds with each other, but not everybody stops thinking at that point. And our guest is one of those people who somehow his art makes the science more accessible. I think that's remarkable. And James, before I turn things over to you, I think it's always good to know a little bit about the people who you're speaking to. So these are the most committed, most knowledgeable activists that you're ever going to talk to. But we're a science-based organization, and those things are kind of hard to measure. So I want to just mention some of the things they did last year. Congress says they don't hear enough from people about climate change. So the people you're spoken with had 1,353 meetings with congressional offices last year, and about an equal number of those were Republicans and Democrats. They made 162,083 personal letters to members of Congress last year and made 48,567 calls. They also believe it's their job to build support in every single congressional district. So if members make a courageous vote, they know there's going to be support for them. So they generated 969 endorsements from prominent people in communities like mayors and college presidents and business owners. They published 2,796 letters to the editor and an astonishing 826 op-eds. So that means more than once every day, a newspaper was giving the people you're talking to a lot of room to make their case for how carbon should be priced. And that op-ed total was figured by an additional 135 in January. So these are very, very active people. There are no casual observers here. They want to be able to take what they're going to hear today and put it to work. So thank you so much for being here. Thank you for all your extraordinary work over the years. And we're just thrilled to have you here.
Well, thank you for that terrific introduction, Mark, and I'm thrilled to be speaking to this audience. I've been very impressed with CCL's work over the years, so this is a great place to be, and I'm glad to be with fellow simpatico individuals, because we're all fighting a tough fight. This little show I'm about to present to you is really derived from this book that you alluded to. It's called The Human Element. And the premise of the book, and it's a very, very large book, it's a retrospective of 40 years of my photography, thinking about the intersection of people and nature. The premise of the book is that we, the human element, are an integral part of nature. We've been conditioned for decades, centuries, millennia, to think of nature being something like earth, air, fire, water, plants, and animals, and that we were on a separate plane outside of it. But what we've seen actually through events like climate change and all its various related issues is that humanity is part of nature. That's a great irony. You know, we in our destruction of nature and our manipulation and changing of nature, we've learned that we are part of it. We're not separate from it. And that whole romantic notion, that ancient notion, goes back a long, long way. So I want to just dive in here this morning to just basically one key part of this this book and the film, The Human Element. By the way, the book is called The Human Element, but we did a film that came out in 2018 that was also called The Human Element. So let me start some pictures for you. So we're all on the same page. The word, the Anthropocene, in case we're somehow confused about what that is, means that we are all part of nature in essence. It's the new science word for our period of geologic time, suggesting that humans are altering the environment. This is a word that came around about 20 years ago. And I think it's a really, really important framing concept to where we are today. Cover of the book. By the way, this is a very large book. This gives you some sense of the scale of this thing. 450 pages, and I dig into a lot of issues in it, from climate to receding glaciers to endangered wildlife, deforestation, changes in air and water, and so forth. And tried to make it as all-encompassing as my little life and pictures can make it. Now, there's one key idea, a word that you're going to hear come up in some of the little stories that I read for you. And the key idea is about human tectonics. Many of us are familiar with the notion of plate tectonics, the idea that there are these massive forces in the earth, in the crust of the earth, moving the rock plates around, making earthquakes like that emanate from places like the San Andreas Fault, which you can see right here. And plate tectonics also create things like volcanoes. And they build mountains. But my point is that we humans are a force of tectonics as well. And one of the key elements of our human tectonics is that we use fire. And we've been using fire for a long time, at least 300,000 years. There's some evidence that the use of fire may go back as much as 700,000 years, but that has been a crucial tool of how we alter the environment through the through our technologies, through the size of our populations, through our desires for affluence and survival. All of those things put together create human tectonics. But fire is a very curious substance, and I want to read you a little something from the book to help shape our thinking about fire. And here goes. Fire is a shape-shifting trickster. Fire is foe, and fire is friend. Fire annihilates, and fire rejuvenates. Fire purifies, and fire terrifies. Fire cleanses, and fire corrupts. Fire is an agent of human tectonics, and fire is the result of human tectonics. Orange flames gave power and comfort since the invention of fire, burning wood, then burning oil, coal, methane gas, the dead ooze of ancient seafloors and forgotten rivers. Now, fire hides its dragon face in thrusting pistons, electric thunderbolts, blazing furnaces. Fuels from the fossil dead give possibility and pleasure. Yet the necropolis comes back to haunt us. Cerulean blanket overhead, once the realm of heavenly hosts, has become a garbage dump, and nature is unnatural. So that's a key idea, to think that the fire that surrounds us today is hidden inside the furnaces. We're still just as dependent on fire as we were when we were sitting at campfires, burning sticks, but we don't see it the same way. And there's a lot of fire hiding inside those internal combustion engines that we all cruise around on in cars, buses, and airplanes. So fire is very much a part of our lives, but it's hidden. So here we are, looking at fire in different ways and shapes and forms, that shape-shifting trickster. And here is a fuel that's so key to our use of fire today, coal. The human volcano looks like a volcano. I'm looking down from a drone that I have on a coal loading facility at a mine in Utah. And these fuels, of course, are creating the changes in the climate, changes in the atmosphere that we all know about. This is a very sophisticated audience I'm speaking to. I don't need to belabor these points. The Anthropocene is a period of time that has been defined, of course, by fire, but also by agriculture, and then subsequently by the burning of fossil fuels as part of the fire story. And in this particular scene, we're in Western Pennsylvania, where you see the two key parts of the Anthropocene of the past 10 or 12,000 years coming together, burning fossil fuels in that coal-fired power plant and agriculture, transforming the landscape. Many people in the earth sciences think that the Anthropocene began when we started agriculture 10 or 12,000 years ago. So there it is. Now I want to share something that I think is really important for us to get our heads around, and that is that we're all in this story together. And I'm going to read you something that comes from an essay I wrote called Carbon Inheritance. And I ask at the beginning, do we have a right to be angry or frustrated about how the climate and energy crisis is altering the world without considering how we ourselves have contributed to it? No one inhabits a righteous, pure, and holy perch far above the human condition. Not you, not me, not anybody else. We all drive our chariots of carbon fire. We all rely on carbon fuels to produce our clothing, food supply, lighting, the thermal comfort in our houses, and much more. Do other ties bind you to fossil fuels? Investments, perhaps? Or is your comfort and prosperity today derived from a family history linked to oil and coal? So let me make a confession. My grandparents, my father's father and my mother's father, were both coal miners in Pennsylvania. And my father's father grew up in a little coal mining town, not very far away from where this picture was taken. And my father's father, Michael, died in the collapse of the coal mine in, when was it, 1946, before I was born. And I never knew him. But I feel a great sense of historical connection to him. And I think we all have historical connections that weave in so many different ways through time and place to fossil fuels. But then as I go on to write, now the wheel of generational destiny turns. How ironic, how mysterious, how improbable is it that fate pushes me, grandson of those miners, into prying up questions about Earth matter, digging not with shovel and dynamite, but with pictures and words, digging not to extract coal, but to end the extraction of coal. To speak and live a different truth from theirs is a task I can no more avoid than they could avoid those coal seams. 4.5 billion years of Earth history, 4 million years of hominid history leading to Homo sapiens, 400 years of agricultural history. Yet only incredibly in the past four generations or so have we understood what human minds never did before. Burning the fossil residue of ancient life poisons our bodies and our world. People of the past never knew this. They did what was necessary in the harsh light of their moment. By the standards of today, we cannot judge them. The urgent task now is to look in our own mirror. Will we shoulder the burdens of the present time with noble determination the way my coal mining ancestors did to make their families survive and live? Are we morally and ethically and intellectually lucid enough to respond in full measure to the knowledge we have about the negative consequences of carbon fuels? I think that's the essence of where we are today. Are we lucid enough? Do we have the energy to respond to these issues? Here's another carbon fuel, oil, in the Gulf of Mexico during the oil spill years ago. That came right out of the bay. The Cajun fisherman who was finding he wasn't catching any fish, but he was sure catching a lot of oil. As we all know, these issues have direct human consequences. They are not abstract, the burning of fossil fuels. And so to a different form of fire that I'd like to share with you. This is from the book. It's a very large body of work about wildfires. And we photographed all of this for the film and then subsequently for the book in all around the American and Canadian West. I find it an incredible force out there in the landscape. And by the way, here's one of the firefighters in California using napalm, which is a jelly gasoline, to light up a fire to prevent the wildfire from catching onto the fuels. These people do unbelievably hard work. They're real heroes. I spent 4 years chasing fires and went to firefighter schools, and my filming team did as well, so that we could learn how not to get ourselves killed out there, learn how fire behaved so we could hope to be in the right place at the right time. It's incredible, incredible work. And the fires are essentially unstoppable under many circumstances. A school bus. This is a fire that almost burned down my own house. How many years ago was that? I can't even remember anymore. 8 or 9 years ago here in the foothills of the Rockies. But it got one of my neighbor's houses and 100 others. One of the firefighting crews that we worked with, Tony Howard from California, and one of his folks, Kerrigan Ferreira, from one of the towns in Northern California. Her main activity in life is lifting weights and running a lot so that she can work really hard on the fire line. She worked harder than any of the guys out there. Really an amazing character. which brings us to yet another theme in the book, sea level rise, and we don't have time to get into that today. So I want to use this picture, though, to set the stage for my final thought that comes from the book. And it's an essay that is called The Human Element. It's buried way in the back of the book, page 442 or something like that. But it's really the essence of the book. And the lyrics are titled The Human Element. So here it goes. The hour is fleeting. The facts of life on Earth are clear, and I submit them for candid consideration. Human tectonics are changing the nature of nature. We depend on the stability of the fundamental elements of the world. An imbalance in the human element leads to an imbalance in the other element. People are the only element that can choose to restore balance. No boundary separates people from nature. In damaging nature, we are damaging ourselves. In protecting nature, we are protecting ourselves. No law or decree, no religion or tradition gives us the right to immolate the inheritance of the ages. True patriotism protects spacious skies and purple mountains, golden valleys and diamond deserts, from pole to gleaming pole and sea to shining sea. The survival of the world depends on us getting our act together. Our survival demands it, and our children deserve it. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Wow, that's beautiful, James. Thank you so much. The link to the Inside Climate News piece is in the action sheet, and I recommend you all read it. If you've read it again. I just love that it starts with that we all have something to do here. It doesn't blame anybody else. It says we've all got skin in this game. You know, we're all going to do it together. Flannery, what are we seeing out there that people are asking about today?
All right. So our first question is from Tamara. First, James, she says, I love your work. I have been deeply moved by a few of your films, Chasing Ice in particular. And she says, thank you for that. But she shares, before I was a part of CCL, I felt pretty helpless regarding what I could do or what could be done to address the gravity of the problem. And I avoided movies like Chasing Ice. What's your perspective on people's tendency to shut down and stay inactive and overwhelmed when they see images of our changing climate?
Yeah, you know, it's one of the essential fundamental problems. A lot of people would rather stick their heads in the sand. I just realize that one has to have a sort of a willful determination to open the eyes and keep on. I'm not going to pretend that the weight of this doesn't get to me. I mean, I spend a lot of time feeling frustrated, oppressed, and overwhelmed by the scope of the problem and how little we sometimes seem to be doing about it. But there is progress. And I think that people just have to have the inner moral and ethical courage to say, I'm not going to let it crush me. I'm not going to curl up in despair and sit in a corner and pull a blanket over my head and ignore all this stuff. That's what I have. And it doesn't come easily. Believe me, there's days when I think I'd like to pull a blanket over my head, but I don't feel like I really have that choice. I just have to keep doing what I'm doing.
Absolutely. When CCL, we say action is the antidote to despair. So we try to just keep moving. Yeah. We have another question here from Robert, who asks, how much are people connecting the extreme conditions they experience and that you photograph to climate change? Do they sense the increase in frequency and intensity?
Yeah, I think people do, even here in the US, including in parts of the country that are more disposed to being dismissive of these issues. The surveys, the poll numbers are showing very, very clearly that people are getting the message from nature. You know, nature has been speaking, or let me say, the rest of nature, non-human nature, has been speaking and showing its hand and showing the consequences of the fossil fuel burning. And people understand that, people get that in their bones, and people see it. And the opinions about this issue have been steadily changing over the past 10 years.
Well, James, thank you so much. Please do feel free to stay on for the next 15 minutes or so. We're going to get a quick legislative update, then we'll go over some of the things that have happened and what we're going to be doing this month, and it might be of interest to you, but thank you so much for that. That was astonishingly beautiful.
Thank you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. And I also just want to give a shout out to Peter Joseph. Thank you for doing the initial recruitment to get Mr. Balog on our advisory board and the initial outreach to have him on the call. So thank you for doing that, Peter. I see Dr. Danny Richter has joined us. And Danny, what can you tell us about where we are and kind of the path that we might chart over the next few months?
Sure. Thank you, Mark. And thank you, James Balog, for that wonderful presentation. Really, really an honor to have you here. So my name is Danny Richter. I'm your Vice President of Government Affairs. And let's get into that legislative update. First of all, reconciliation remains something that members of Congress are pushing for, and they're pushing for a carbon price as part of it. This remains a possibility. Since our last national call, we have heard Joe Manchin, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden all say that they believe that the climate portions of the reconciliation bill discussed so far were the easiest to get agreement on. So while they have said, some have said that they are, quote unquote, starting from scratch on reconciliation, and while we have been advised to stop calling the reconciliation bill Build Back Better for marketing purposes, it would appear that if anything passes, it will include a lot for the climate. As climate advocates, we should feel really good about that. When President Biden was expressing this, he did say that it might be good to break up the reconciliation package into, quote unquote, chunks. And I know that this word in particular has created some confusion, so let me clarify. He was not saying that there would be multiple reconciliation bills. There's still only going to be one shot at a reconciliation bill this Congress that achieves big climate aims. But portions of other Democratic priorities, such as healthcare or investments in families, are either going to be squeezed into other bills that might pass through regular order, attempted as standalone bills, or left for a future Congress. For us as climate advocates, I think this underscores how significant it is that Joe Manchin, Joe Biden, and Nancy Pelosi all agree that climate is the easiest to get agreement on, and that is definitely part of any reconciliation bill that might move forward. Now let's talk about timing. Right now, Congress is extraordinarily busy. They need to fund the government. They're trying to work on a bill about our competitiveness with China. The State of the Union is coming up. Appropriations is in April, there's President Biden's Supreme Court pick, and there are many other things besides. Here is our expectation. Quiet conversations are going on right now about what will be in the reconciliation bill on the sidelines as all of these other priorities are being worked through. And once a new framework has been built, Congress, and really we're talking about the Senate here, will again take up reconciliation in a serious way. This is probably going to take months, meaning that our June lobby day may end up being particularly well-timed. In the meantime, we have some breathing room to build our power in district, in state, while still keeping constituent pressure on both Democrats and Republicans to act on climate. And that is what our actions this month are about. Speaking of Republicans, I'd like to talk about them for a moment. Some of you have expressed concerns that by focusing on reconciliation, CCL has forgotten about Republicans. I can see how this makes sense from a CCL volunteer perspective. However, I'd like to invite you to consider the perspective of congressional Republicans. What they have seen over the past year is CCL volunteers supporting the growing Climate Solutions Act, which passed the Senate 92-8. They have seen you push for the Forest Act and the RISE Act in November, which are two bills that many of them can see themselves supporting, like the Growing Climate Solutions Act, and they're seeing us as helping them. Senator Braun, who leads the Senate Climate Solutions Caucus along with Senator Coons, was of course the lead Republican on the Growing Climate Solutions Act. So the Republican lead on that bill and the lead of the Senate Climate Solutions Caucus feels very supported by CCL, and like we've been effective in giving him the climate and the Climate Solutions Caucus a win. The same is true for Representative Curtis in the House, who founded the Conservative Climate Caucus, saw it shoot rapidly to over 70 Republican members, and is in the habit of thanking CCL, both his constituents who have built a heck of a relationship with him and CCL National as important supporters of the Conservative Climate Caucus. My team here in DC has also been busy on all of these fronts, complementing volunteer efforts. And of course, please remember, three of my staff are former Republican staff on the Hill. What you have currently is Republican leadership, including Leader McCarthy and Mitch McConnell, saying that they need a plan on climate for next Congress, and they are putting themselves on the hook by saying this to deliver that. I think that the people on this call should claim some credit for that. Short, if you take the view of congressional Republicans, CCL has never been more helpful, more present, or more impactful as we've been over the past year towards the goal of a Republican Party that can vote for and pass climate legislation. As I said in my remarks at our November conference, more Republicans are walking in the direction of climate action than ever before, and it is easier to get someone to walk faster in the direction they're already heading than to get them to change directions. We are succeeding in getting them to walk faster in the direction of climate action. Finally, I want to speak to what Mark and Madeline queued up at the November conference, namely the possibility that CCL would be expanding our policy focus. This is a process that we have begun with a sense of deep humility about what we are undertaking. We're entering this process with truly open minds as we seek expert and stakeholder opinions on what are the other big things that we could spend our time trying to achieve, including scientists, economists, environmental justice advocates representing frontline communities, of course, our volunteers, as well as other stakeholders. A little about how this might work. Obviously, we have our primary asks and we have our supporting asks. What we are undertaking is to add 1 to 3 additional primary ask level policies. And please let me set some expectations here. First, it's going to take a while before we finish our consultation process. Second, even if we could finish that with lightning speed, we don't think at this time that it would make much sense to do that before the reconciliation opportunity, for which we remain hopeful, is played out. Third, carbon fee and dividend will always be a priority. If a version of carbon price passes in reconciliation, we will be busy defending it and strengthening it. And if it doesn't, we will continue advocating for it. Fourth, I want to point out that we have all become used to a level of knowledge and detail around carbon fee and dividend and its impacts that it has, after all, taken us 13 years to build up to. So when we start advocating for other policies, we will start building up our training and expertise, but please keep in mind that will take some time. So that is what I wanted to share with you in this legislative update.
Danny, can I ask you one question? So sure. You've been on the calls with some of the people we've been talking to outside the organization, and can you just give a flavor of how those calls are going and how those people are approaching the process?
They're smart, and they know a lot about the options that are out there. It's been interesting to try and extract for them. I think that they're used to thinking about what is the easiest thing. And of course, that's not what we're after. we're after the big things. And so we have to kind of work them a little bit, like we're kneading some bread to really get them to extend a little bit. So it's been a little bit of work to get them to really get on board with the ambition that we have always had here at CCL. But I think we are getting to some very interesting thoughts. We remain early in this process, but we're doing the work.
Nice, great update, Danny, and thank you for that extra little piece there too. Appreciate it. Okay, so what are we doing this month? First of all, the first action we have is related to letters to the editor and op-eds, and our good fortune is the senior director of communications is actually on the call, so she can tell us a little bit about that, Flannery Winchester.
All right, hello. So our first action this month, as you said, is to write letters to the editor and op-eds, and also to start planning what media activities your chapter will do throughout this year. So local media is a hugely important tool for us to use because we know that congressional offices pay attention to it, especially when the representative or the senator is mentioned by name in the media. And right now is a great time to write letters and op-eds because we've spent the last few months generating tens of thousands of calls and emails about climate legislation. And now local media can help us keep up that pressure in a fresh and even more public way. So I wanna make you aware of a few resources we have to help you write these letters and op-eds. We have a document of recommended LTE topics available on CCL Community, which which are updated on a regular basis, and you can use those ideas to start writing a letter. We also have outlines that you can use for inspiration and guidance to write op-eds, which are longer pieces. And all of these resources are created by our wonderful state and local media coordinator, Charlotte Ward, who is available to help you and your chapter with any questions that you have about local media work. Charlotte also hosts a monthly letter writing party on Zoom, where you can log on from your computer, get letter ideas, spend some focused time actually writing your letter, and then share your draft and get support from other folks on the call. So these LTE events are open to any volunteer from any chapter, and they take place on the second Tuesday of every month, and you can find the information on the CCL community event calendar or in the action sheet this month. And lastly, I just want to thank all the volunteers who are already writing letters and op-eds in your local newspapers. Last year, just in the US alone, you published 732 op-eds and 2,404 letters to the editor. So that's amazing. Let's keep it up.
Yeah, and 135 in January, Flannery. I mean, that's just an incredible start to the year. How did that happen?
People are rocking and rolling.
Okay, great. Flannery, thanks so much, and thanks for being so brilliant at your job. So there's two other things that we're asking you to do. One is to start to plan a in-person spring event. We can do it, probably outside. Some places it might work, some places it might not, but begin to plan one. Might be around Earth Day. But boy, the idea of getting together sounds pretty good to me. And then the other thing is, we will be having our second ever conservative conference in March 29th and 30th in Washington, DC. And for anybody that you know who's right of center, if you would please reach out to them, invite them to the conference. You know, if we are not providing a grassroots effort to build conservative support, it's not gonna happen. So it's really important for any of you who have people who are right of center in your chapter, you know people who are right of center, please make sure and invite them to the event. Last time was wildly successful, and we'd like to get as many people who are right of center and showing, particularly Republican members of Congress, that there is support from people who have the same political persuasion as they have. So please reach out to those people if you can. Okay, a couple of things to report on since last month's call. So in the November conference, the live event, I don't have the recorded numbers yet, but the live event, 2,393 people attended, and that included every single US state. So we had people from all 50 states and the district attending the November conference. Also for countries outside of the US who attended, included Australia, Bangladesh, Canada, the Democratic Republic of Congo, France, Germany, India, Indonesia, Japan, Mexico, the Netherlands, Nigeria, South Africa, Tanzania, Thailand, Tunisia, Ukraine, and the United Kingdom. So of the 2,393 people, all 50 states and those countries outside, and I, again, do not have the information on the recordings yet. Also, the Virginia Economist statement came out. So we've got another state where 25 economists signed a letter essentially supporting our proposal. Those local economists are so important to that particular community. So for everybody who was involved in that, thank you for that really extraordinary work. And I also want to just reference back to the Mid-Atlantic conference that happened last weekend. So that's the first regional conference we've had in a while. And there were speakers from the NAACP, from Audubon, and it was a really interesting event because it was a combination of both some virtual and some in person, and Sabrina and everybody who was involved with that regional conference. Thank you for putting that on and for getting so many great speakers. Okay, last thing I want to mention is this. So we will be having our June conference, June 11th through 13th. Registration will open up soon. And for the first time ever, we are going to be inviting our 146 chapters around the world to lobby the same work week that we're lobbying. So usually this has just been a US lobbying effort. We've usually had a lot of Canadians at the conference, and we were live in DC. They've done things like lobbied the World Bank and stuff. But this is something where we'll be doing a worldwide effort. In some cases, it will happen before because the Canadian conference is in May and they'll be doing the lobbying right after that. But we'll be inviting the rest of the world to join us. So what are some of them going to be doing? In Mexico, they're going to be lobbying on their country's carbon pricing. They're going to be asking for it to be more transparent, and that they're going to ask them to show how to have money distributed back to the people and to have the carbon price be more stringent. In Canada, they're going to be asking for improvements on the Greenhouse Gas Pollution Act of 2018, which is their climate income policy. In Nigeria, they're asking that their country's carbon pricing policy be a climate income and also enshrine evidence-based climate policy into Nigerian laws. And in Europe, they'll be lobbying Brussels on the carbon pricing in Europe to include a significant climate income component. In Australia, will be asking their MPs to adopt an efficient carbon price and their government to legislate their promises for net zero by 2050. So a lot of our friends around the world would be doing making very similar asks to what we'll be making in the US. And it'll be really exciting to be making a worldwide push during that time. So again, I want to thank our guest, James Baylogs. Thank you so much for making yourself available, for making a beautiful presentation, for your life's work being so extraordinary and such a gift to all of us. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next month. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.